This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, on podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Tonight we are joined by a regular panelist, Professor Samuel Mann, and a guest tonight is Dr. Sarah Corbis, and another are special interviews with world-leading mammal experts, marine mammal experts, 1,200 of whom are here in Dunedin for the 20th Biennial Conference on Marine Mammals, and your host is me, Shane Gallagher. Dr. Sarah Corbis is a researcher at Portland State University in the United States and is researching the swim with dolphins ecotourism and its impacts on wildlife, as well as she's an expert on genetics. She's presenting a paper here on social science research regarding ways to affect people's attitudes and behaviours towards marine mammals and other charismatic wildlife. She also worked for the Humpback Whale Sanctuary for a number of years in Hawaii. And she says that it's really interesting that she begins to see a shift from simply focusing on recovery to working with people to live in harmony with whales, porpoises and dolphins. Welcome to our show, Sarah.
Thank you.
So did you fly directly from Portland, or is there somewhere else that you're based in?
No, I came from Portland. It's a long flight.
And have you been to New Zealand before?
No, this is my first time.
Cool. Brilliant. And so where were you born?
Pennsylvania, which is on the east coast of the United States.
Does that have any seaboard at all?
Or
another one of the inland?
Yes.
Because so many of the researchers are actually from inland. I mean, what got you interested in marine mammals?
Well, actually, it was the Oregon coast that did. I have relatives out in Oregon, and I visited when I was a kid out there. Okay. So I thought everything out there, actually, all the wildlife in the ocean was really amazing. So I decided to study that when I went to college.
Well, so did you study biology or zoology or?
Marine biology.
Marine biology, directly, okay. And so you work in Portland State University as a researcher. Mm-hmm. And what are you currently researching there?
Well, one of the areas that we're researching is this interaction with marine mammals. And I recently forayed into this more social science area in collaboration with the University of Hawaii. We have some researchers working with us there who know how to do the social science statistics and surveys.
Yeah.
So we're bringing sort of the biology and ecology to the table, you know, and they bring the social science. But we're trying to find ways to help reduce some of the disturbance and interactions with marine mammals in Hawaii, which they get 7 million tourists a year to Hawaii. So it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem.
So it's quite huge. And what kind of dolphins do you see around Hawaii?
There's actually 18 species of odontocetes that live in Hawaii. Odontocetes are the toothed whales, which include the dolphins. Some of the most common ones are the spinner dolphins and the spotted dolphins and the pilot whales, very common near shore. And spinner dolphins come into bays to rest during the day, so they're very accessible to people.
So the spinner dolphins coming in, are they friendly or are they shy creatures or what?
Well, you know, in watching them from, I did a lot of my research from land-based locations and use binoculars and spotting scopes and things and look at people's behavior and dolphin behavior. And it seems like, generally speaking, dolphins tend to move away from people when they're in the water coming toward them. But there certainly are instances where dolphins approach people as well. Sometimes they can be curious, but mainly what they're trying to do is rest. So it's kind of like if someone were chasing you around your bedroom all night, you know. So they kind of move off to the side and try to rest, and then people follow them, and then they move off to the other side and kind of go back and forth most of the day that way.
Now, is this kind of a casual thing? People are spotting the dolphins in the water and kind of going after them in their paddling boats or in their power boats, or is it something more organized? Are people taking them out in tourism? Are people trying to make money out of it?
It's both. Okay. You can, you know, see dolphins from shore and get to dolphins from shore, particularly spinner dolphins in Hawaii. So there are people who simply stand out there every day, look for dolphins and chase them around. But there's also quite a big tourism industry associated with it. And different operators behave differently. I mean, there are plenty of responsible operators in Hawaii that are very careful about approaching dolphins too closely and cutting dolphins off. There's even a Dolphin Smart program in Hawaii that you can get a recognition mm-hmm. that says that you're being a responsible operator. But there's also people who are not.
And they're just like, they just see dolphins, and kind of just chase after them. Mm-hmm. Have no yeah. real thought about what they're doing.
That can happen. I mean, it's market driven. So, I mean, mm-hmm. part of it is that consumers need to understand that these close interactions with dolphins actually can be harmful to dolphins in the long run. Some of the studies out of this part of the country, should say Australia. I know New Zealanders don't really want to be lumped
Australian.
In with Australia. But there's been research in New Zealand as well mm-hmm. that shows that that sometimes there can even be population level effects. Some of the bottlenose mm-hmm. dolphin studies in Australia show as much as twice as much calf mortality for animals that are being interacted with by people because they tend to ignore their calves and they get eaten by sharks and things. So people think, oh, well, dolphins choose to interact with me. They want to play with me. And they might, but even if they do, they may have something else they should be doing and it's going to hurt them in the long run.
Wow. So there has been studies showing like the actual negative effects on the dolphins.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And in Hawaii as well, we haven't been able to do the kind of research to the level that they have out here. But we do see changes in behavior and over the long term that seem to indicate problems. And there is some evidence recently, very recently, I just saw a talk, 2 days ago that suggests that there may be some declines in spinner dolphin populations on the west coast of Hawaii Island.
Are they easy mammals to observe? Because a lot of the dolphins and porpoises we've been talking about on the show are like, they love turbid waters, they're, the river dolphins are kind of quite easy, hard to spot. A spinner dolphin is easy to spot and easy to observe?
Spinner dolphins are because they're very predictable. They need to use those resting bays, and so you can fairly predictably find them there. The interesting thing about all this tourism is it hasn't necessarily decreased a lot of their usage, although some localized areas it seems to have. But they just need to rest in those areas. They don't seem to have somewhere else to go. So you can find them.
All right. And this lack of sleep is obviously affecting their ability probably to hunt and to
That's what we suspect.
Get fish and look after each other. And
sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So with that research, so you also worked on the whales, humpback whale sanctuary from Hawaii. And what kind of effects are people observing humpback whales as well? Or
yeah, well, humpback whales is a little bit different case in mm-hmm. Hawaii. The populations have been increasing over the last couple decades, which is wonderful news for the recovery of humpback whales. But it means there's a lot more interactions with people just because there are more whales in the water and more people on the water. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to manage interactions to avoid ship strikes and too many close encounters. There are, of course, calving while they're there and mating. So it's important that they're not disturbed while they're trying to do those important behaviors.
What makes a sanctuary?
In the United States, there's a law that is the National Marine Sanctuaries Act. And In the case of Hawaii, it was actually Congress designated the Hawaiian Islands as a humpback whale sanctuary with specific borders. It's actually non-contiguous pieces around the main Hawaiian Islands.
So how is that enforced? Is there a good enforcement or a bad enforcement?
Well, the interesting thing about the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary is there really aren't any regulations that don't already exist under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So technically, there's nothing to enforce in that sanctuary. So sanctuary in the U.S. doesn't necessarily mean we will now ban all things that happen in this place. It means we think it's a special place that we want to manage and think about how we can help people interact with their environment better. So there's a lot of education and outreach activities. And in some cases, there's regulation, but in the case of Hawaii, there's not. But there is a rule in place that you can't approach a humpback whale in the Hawaiian Islands closer than 100 yards. So that is enforced, and there is prosecution when people break that rule.
Is there interaction with fishing?
I shouldn't say there's not. There is. It's not as big of a problem in Hawaii as it is in Alaska. Because whales are actively feeding in Alaska, and they tend to get more entangled in gear. But there are certain fisheries in Hawaii where we find entanglements. And that's actually one of the things that the sanctuary has been a big part in studying, because they operate the disentanglement program. So they actually send people out to disentangle whales caught in gear, collect that gear, try to figure out where it came from, what kind of fishery it was in. And that's helped us to figure out that there is some interaction in Hawaii, and people certainly in the fisheries have concerns, because no one wants to catch whales or injure whales or lose their gear or lose their catch or any of those sorts of things. So we that the sanctuary works very closely with the fishing industry on that.
With all wildlife, you can't actually tell the wildlife that it's a sanctuary.
No.
And there's no way of encouraging them into that special place, or is it just more that you've named the special place where they are anyway?
Well, that sanctuary was designated based on surveys that indicated those were the high-density areas for that species. Now, as the numbers have increased, it's probably likely that they are in higher densities outside of the sanctuary area too. But the nice thing about the United States is that we do have an overarching Marine Mammal Protection Act that protects them in other ways outside of the sanctuary.
And does that protection leak, for want of a better word, to other species?
Oh, yes, it does. And actually, there are quite a few people with a lot of interesting expertise that work with the Sanctuary Advisory Council. And so, you know, the sanctuary is engaged with a lot of things that, and the state co-manages the sanctuary. So the state fisheries agency, of course, is working with turtle issues and monk seal issues and other kinds of animals. So the sanctuary and the state work together to help solve those problems and support each other.
What are the problems that the turtles face?
Well, turtles interact with fisheries as well. And there's also a lot of tourism. And this is another thing we were looking at with the study that we did, because it's not just dolphins or seals that people are poaching, but turtles. And there's, you know, lots of disturbing footage online where people are riding turtles or, you know, sitting on turtles. And, you know, people just don't recognize that it's actually harmful to the animals to do that kind of stuff. So we're trying very hard to work with local communities, and there's actually some great NGOs out in Hawaii that actually send out people to be docents and talk to people on beaches and encourage them to not interfere with turtles. But, you know, there's only so many people that can get to so many beaches.
Yeah, that was actually leading this nicely into the question I was going to ask. So at a state the federal level, is that what I was talking about? Does that sanctuary was done at the federal level?
Yes, yeah, that's okay. Right.
So what kind of local organizations are helping back up or maybe overlap?
There are a lot of little NGOs that are fairly local. The Malamana Honu is a great example of a turtle organization that those are the ones that go out 365 days a year to talk to people about turtles. And there's a lot of community interest in local areas in working with people to reduce interactions. The Dolphin Smart program also has been really good, although that's mainly driven by NOAA. It also needs to be, you know, community-based and have that collaboration go on for local operators to choose to do it, because it's not a regulation.
So tell us what the Dolphin Smart program is.
The Dolphin Smart program started on the East Coast of the United States, and it's a program that was actually developed through several NGOs and NOAA to help recognize tour operators that would follow certain rules about how they interact with dolphins. So they don't swim with dolphins. They don't use footage in their advertising of people swimming with dolphins or approaching really closely to dolphins. And they even have things that are unrelated to dolphins, like you're not allowed to be touching turtles or picking things up off the reef or things of that nature that is also detrimental to the wildlife in the area. So that's a great recognition program. If someone has that recognition, you can use that to tell you that's a tour operator that's going to do the right thing. There's other recognition programs that maybe are looking at other issues, and perhaps that, you know, green tourism, maybe they say, oh, you're a green tour because you use less fuel than somebody else or something. But you have to check a website and make sure what are the actual criteria that they're setting before you choose an operator based on a recognition program.
Slightly ironically, perhaps, if you don't care, not having the Dolphin Smart suggests you're going to have a better time.
Well, actually, I just went to a talk today that suggested that you won't. There was a study that was done in Australia that looked at compliance with rules and regulations associated with dolphin tourism there, and they actually found that avoidance behaviors of dolphins were much higher when tour operators didn't follow the rules. So as a tourist, if you have say you're in Hawaii and they're leapfrogging, we call that, where they'll drop people in the middle of a group of dolphins and then they'll pick them back up and zoom ahead and cut the dolphins off again and drop them in front of them and keep doing that because the dolphins keep moving away. Well, in that case, you've got people who are being dropped in the water for a few seconds while dolphins run away from them. Now, as a tourist, you might actually have a better experience if you're on a boat that's keeping a reasonable distance from the dolphins and you get to watch them for an hour jumping and leaping and enjoying themselves in their natural environment. So it depends. And most of the people who choose to do tours, according to the study that we just did, are more likely to be people who actually do care. They're more likely to be people who do beach cleanups and recycle and eat sustainable seafood. They actually care about the environment, they just don't necessarily realize that some of these activities can be harmful to dolphins.
So how would a tourist who, you know, from mainland of the United States arrived in Hawaii, wants to go and see dolphins, how would they know about the SMART program? How would they recognize that that was actually something that's a good thing?
Well, the NOAA does have a website that does describe things about guidelines about how they suggest people interact with wildlife. Mm-hmm. And Dolphin Smart has its own website, and it's also in collaboration with the sanctuary. Unfortunately, like you say, I mean, people have to know about these things, and there's a lot more advertising with someone with a GoPro camera chasing a dolphin underwater than there is that there's these resources that you can use to find tour operators. They think that if they show you pictures of dolphins up close and put you in to swim with dolphins, that you're going to want to take their tour more. But as I say, I think the reality is that people want to have an experience where they aren't harming the animal and they get to be around them perhaps longer than some of these swim with programs.
So you've done a survey of visitors to Hawaii?
Yes, that's right. And it was U.S. visitors to Hawaii, so a somewhat rarefied group, but that's the largest proportion of the visitors to Hawaii.
And is that of people that did take the tour or the total sample?
No, we did it through an online survey system. So it was people who were planning to or had visited Hawaii in the next 3 years, I think it was. And we had a sample of about 241 people. And we set it up in this way where, like, survey people are very clever. So they ask these questions to, like, ferret out people who would just pick the box, yes, I'm going to Hawaii because I want to fill out the survey, you know. So they so they go through a whole battery of questions, and then the people who, you know, sort of pass through that sieve then get to go on and answer the survey questions.
And what were you hoping to find out?
Well, we were very interested in informing this public service announcement that we were putting together. We wanted to figure out what approaches are the best to take to really convince people that they should avoid close approaches to wildlife. I think a lot of people just don't believe that it's harmful, you know. So we were trying to come up with ways that we could approach it, whether it's empathy or sympathy or social values or things of that nature. And we also wanted to understand what drives, you know, why do they want to be close to these animals? And we were not necessarily surprised, but we found it was interesting that a large proportion of people who are likely to harass animals also were very ecologically minded. It wasn't people who just didn't care if they hurt the animals. We also found, interestingly, that we asked whether or not a battery of different types of people would be trusted sources of information. And only 1% of our surveyed people said they would trust Hawaiians to tell them about Hawaii's wildlife. But 73% would trust guidebook authors who get paid by various commercial interests to include things in their guidebooks. So it's a really interesting thing to know that gives us the opportunity to say, well, maybe we need to be doing something in guidebooks, because putting a Hawaiian up there saying, please don't destroy my wildlife, is not going to do the trick, you know?
Just stepping back a little bit, how did you identify the people who were ecologically minded?
Well, they used a technique with statistics where they ask a battery of different questions, some of which are sort of similar to others, and then they do it. There's an analysis that sort of pulls out factors that seem to group together. And so people who tended to answer questions in a way that indicated they were interested in conservation and activities that would be conservation oriented sort of fell into a group, and people who answered questions that indicated that they wanted to get very close to wildlife or feed wildlife or other things that we considered harassment or disturbance also fell out into a group, and there was a statistically significant overlap in those two groups.
Were they aware of things like the protection laws and so on?
No, actually, surprisingly, there was very few people who were aware that there were laws protecting the animals or that there were recognition programs. And that was one of the things that we incorporated then into our public service announcement as a result, is to let people know that there are recognition programs and choices in operators. But yeah, you'd think most people from the United States would be familiar with the fact that they're not supposed to bother marine mammals. I don't know. It was surprising to us.
But a lot of them don't come from the coast.
Well, that's true. You know, it's so hard to say when you work around dolphins all the time. You're so used to the Marine Mammal Protection Act that you forget that people have a million other things to think about when they're living in Nebraska.
When I lived in Nebraska, the thing that struck me was the pictures on the fridges and the walls of the first time that each of the children had been to the coast, had been to the sea. And that was the the pride of place in the house. They made it to the sea. It was something that, coming from a small place with lots of sea, is quite remarkable.
I imagine a lot of Americans never go to the ocean in their lifetime.
So it might be a hard ask expecting them to know that marine mammals are being looked after.
It might, although they certainly get a lot of media attention. So a lot of people were interested in marine mammals, and certainly if they come to a place like Hawaii, they often want to see them. So
these public service announcements, what kind of form do they take? I mean, is it radio? Are they posters? Or is it, when you arrive in the airport, somebody like handed you a leaflet? So read this.
That's a great question. For the ones that we did, we actually made video public service announcements. Right. And it would be wonderful if we could put them onto the airlines. That was really one of our major goals with it, and we have not gotten to that, manage that yet. Part of the problem, of course, is airlines want you to buy space, or they want a mandate to put something on. And it's very difficult to get them to donate some airtime to things of that nature. But it's not off the table entirely. And the PSAs are freely available. It's the roarhawaii.org website. And you can download them and use them even. So we've allowed a lot of our partners. We probably had a good 30 different partners, agencies and organizations that have access to use them.
Did you build into those public service announcements encouraging people to intervene, right, to take responsibility if they see other things, if they see other people harassing?
Well, it's always nice if people will call in something like that. We usually don't encourage people to confront someone because that could potentially be, bad for them. But if we're able to document that someone is actually harassed a marine mammal. The difficulty in the United States with that statute is that harassment is defined basically as like tormenting the animal or changing the behavior of the animal. And the only way that you can really prosecute that is if you can prove that, say, the behavior of the animal changed from prior. Well, if nobody's documenting what the behavior is before the person jumped in the water, then you have trouble going to court. And it's also all done under criminal justice system, which is challenging because, after having a murderer in their, courtroom, judges are not that excited about wildlife cases. They're like, what's the big deal, So it can be very difficult to prosecute those cases. But that doesn't mean it's not worth turning people in or taking pictures. Video and things like that can be extremely helpful. Now, we would never encourage someone to put themselves in harm's way. But if you're able to document something in the U.S., turn it into NOAA, and they can potentially prosecute it.
So, cable TV, we have animal cops, Houston, animal cops, Miami. Are there animal cops for dolphins? They seem quite serious. I mean, they're in uniforms and they go up and arrest people for harassing dogs. Yeah. So, I don't know, it's on TV. They have camera crews following them around and arresting people who are maltreating dogs and cats. So there's not that level of kind of involvement, is there, with the dolphin, obviously the wildlife?
Well, there is, money is always an issue for enforcement on water. I mean, and you have to have boats, you have to have the staff to go out. Both NOAA and the state of Hawaii enforce the Marine Mammal Protection Act around Hawaii, and there are times where they bring evidence to the prosecutors and attempt to prosecute cases. So it's not that it never happens, but we certainly don't have the manpower that would be necessary to fully enforce all of that.
Do the dolphins ever kind of, I've seen tourists wander up to seals here on the coast of New Zealand, and you sit there and wait, okay, when's the seal going to bark at them or going to a crooked lunge? And then they run away and go, oh. I've seen a few of them fall on their bums. Mm-hmm. And that's quite funny. But obviously the turtles have no way of defending themselves. They're obviously just trying to, but do the dolphins ever kind of get grumpy and kind of,
They do. Actually, there are actually cases of dolphins killing people. In the wild, not just in captivity. That does happen sometimes. Generally speaking, when that's happened, someone's been doing something really annoying to the dolphin, like trying to cram a popsicle stick in its blowhole or something to, really irritate it. But they do have, they're bigger than people. They also don't necessarily know people's capability of breath holding and things. I mean, even just playing or accidentally, they could hurt a person. I think we're lucky that dolphins generally just tend to stay sort of away from us rather than interacting and pulling us underwater. There was an incident with a pilot whale where someone was dragged underwater while they were filming, and they were held underwater for several minutes, but luckily were released early enough to not drown. So it does happen. And, you know, people say, oh, dolphins push people into shore and save their lives. I'm like, because you never hear from the guy they pushed out to sea.
Because I know, like, sharks is frightened of stay away from dolphins. So I was thinking of sharks. You know, great whites are kind of a bit nervous of dolphins. So it must be quite bad, you know.
It depends on the dolphin, too. You know, the killer whales are, you know, serious business. And there's footage of them killing great white sharks, which is pretty impressive. How dolphins tend to do this is they ram into the animal. So if a dolphin perceives you as a threat, that could be their response to you. And particularly when people feed dolphins or things like that, just like any wild animal, they tend to get a bit aggressive and they'll bite and things of that nature. The interesting thing about – everybody loves bottlenose dolphins, right, because they're flipper dolphins. And they're actually one of the more aggressive dolphins. And the posture of a person in the water upright is actually – would be their threat posture to each other. Oh. If they want to threaten each other, they're upright in the water. So, you know, we don't even think about how they're perceiving us in the water, and in some cases where we may actually be sending a threat message we don't intend to send.
We've interviewed a couple of people who are frog experts. And we asked them, sort of in passing, because it was mildly humorous at the time, we asked them about Kermit. And one of them said that he loves Kermit. He's like, Kermit opens the doors. It's something that the kids can identify with, and he's funny, and he's cute, and he sings, and all that sort of stuff. And the other one said he wished that Kermit never happened, because it just sets the frogs up in totally the wrong way. He spends his time sort of clawing back from those very perceptions. So I was about to ask, and you mentioned it coincidentally, Flipper. Does Flipper help?
I don't think Flipper helps. I think at the time that that Flipper and the Marine Mammal Protection Act came into being in the United States, there were many, many, many dolphins being killed in the tuna purse seine fishery. And this was such an issue that it was, you know, sort of brought to the public's attention as this giant mass killing of dolphins. And then there were these John C. Lilly's books and Flipper and things that convinced people that dolphins were kind of like people and therefore they should protect them. So it did serve a purpose to get people engaged and interested in something they weren't interested in before. But in making it look like wild animals are pets, it encourages people to think that they can just go out and touch them and play with them and that it's not going to be harmful to themselves or the animal, which isn't really true. So maybe it's a double-edged sword.
What about SpongeBob?
I've never seen what does he do to dolphins?
It doesn't do anything to dolphins, but so I was just wondering about the engaging people in that sort of in that ecosystem, but in a very twisted way.
You know, it's so hard to say. It's frustrating as a scientist to see animals anthropomorphize so much in an effort to get people interested. And it's also part of, I mean, it's a marketing campaign. It's the same as using these charismatic animals like a panda bear or a polar bear. It's not even really about saving a panda bear or a polar bear as much as it's about saving an ecosystem in which they live, and that will save them. It's habitat destruction that's the biggest threat to almost every animal on the planet. So you use some of this stuff in your marketing to help get people engaged, but then sometimes I think it can go too far. People got so interested in dolphins that they started to think dolphins wanted them to have babies next to them and things, which is, you know, it gets to the point of being ridiculous and dangerous at a certain level.
When you're doing work particularly with the school kids, what's the opening line? How do you engage them?
Well, when I work with school kids, I usually do activities to be interesting. I have a big rope where I've marked off different sizes of whales and dolphins. So, like you say, kids who are inland have never seen anything like this, too. So you can actually make them go across a whole room, you know, with a 100 feet of rope to show how big, you know, in a 23 feet in, you've got a, you know, blue whale calf size. I mean, kids always are just amazed by the actual size of these animals. And I like to do little exercises with them about science, too, you know, looking at, like, photo ID and noises. Kids love marine mammal sounds. There are so many things now on the Internet. If you're interested in that, it's really cool to listen to these different things. So you can get them interested in it without making the animals into people. And I actually think dolphins are fascinating for what they are. I don't think they have to be like people to be really cool. People are always, oh, aren't dolphins smart? And dolphins can talk to each other and dolphins, you know, all these things. And they are very, they have great memories, and they are really amazing social mammals with lots of cool behaviors and really intricate relationships. I don't think they have to be thinking like people or acting like people in order to be interesting.
I've asked this question a couple of times of our guests now. I mean, who, Jacques Cousteau was, you know, the man and the team that brought, you know, the ocean to life for me. Where is, you know, where do you think, why do you think there's no great community? I mean, David Attenborough is still out there communicating about, you know, amazing species. Why, with dolphins and porpoises and whales being such charismatic animals, where's the great communicator? And why do you think that hasn't, you know, somebody hasn't stepped forward and telling the story of the dolphins and the whales? And
well, to some degree, there were people who did. As I say, I mean, John C. Lilly certainly made his crack at that. And, you know, Ken Norris was quite a champion of dolphins and one of the fathers of research for dolphins and wrote quite a few books. Mm. There are a number of people who sort of tried to bring it to the lay audience and other people who still do. Roger Payne has written some lay books, Karen Pryor. But I think the media has changed now. So probably it's a different thing. You're like one of hundreds of thousands of voices rather than, you know, in the past there wasn't the internet and all these other things. So maybe the way we do our messaging, I went to a talk today too about talking about how do we use Facebook to get information. And it sounds a little weird to scientists. We're not necessarily like, oh, I don't know about all this social media and stuff, but this is the new way. So it's not necessarily going to be one voice, I think, that tells these stories. It's going to be probably collaborations of people who get together and use the media in a way that we need to use it today to get the message out.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing is, I mean, when I was a child, obviously, there was, you know, the internet hadn't been invented. I know, shucks on her. Well, it had been, but we didn't have the interweb. So we had, you know, and now I can just, like, type into Google, you know, dolphins, and, like, hundreds, millions of articles come up. And so there is a vast amount of information out there. And is it just that we have to relocalize and take – do people take ownership of their local dolphins? Because we were talking about Tara Whitty, and she was saying, like, how, you know, the local people in Cambodia and the Philippines didn't really have ownership of the local dolphins. They're just there and they just hung around and they're kind of nice. But in Thailand, they had taken ownership of them. Is that what needs to happen, do you think? You know, the local communities need to take ownership and say, these are our dolphins and we need to look after them, protect them and you know, care for them. Is that what you think needs to happen?
I do agree with that. I think in Hawaii, one of the things that has been a challenge is we are only learning very recently that the dolphins of Hawaii are actually local dolphins. They're island, in many cases, they don't even leave a particular island that often, which you would think a dolphin can go wherever. But, I mean, you find the same thing in New Zealand with the Hector's dolphins. They don't really travel that far from where they are born. So dolphins are local populations, and the U.S. also has discouraged, to some degree, I think, local ownership because the federal government has taken all responsibility for them under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and, in fact, doesn't allow states or communities to make any management rules or anything of that nature associated with marine mammals. It's expressly prohibited in the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So say a state like Hawaii wants to make a rule to keep people from swimming with dolphins, let's say.
Yeah.
They can't. Or you could, but when you went to court, it would be overturned because the federal law states that you can't make that rule.
What was the thinking behind that?
I'm not entirely sure. I think that they didn't want states to make less restrictive rules. But what would have been nice is if they'd made a clause like the Endangered Species Act, where as long as the rule is more protective rather than less protective, it would be allowed. I guess I can't be sure what Congress was thinking at the time, but maybe someday they'll rewrite that because there's plenty of communities and states that would like to better manage those things, but now they're kind of relegated. They can do research or monitoring or education, but they can't actually make rules.
So that's really interesting because if local communities' hands are tied regulation-wise, how do you then encourage, apart from, you know, saying, look, this is you know, these are positive things you should be doing. How else do you get people to do the right thing? What kind of other programs are available, or have you come across anything fascinating or interesting in that regard?
Well, I think that in today's world, we really have to have collaborative work so that the scientists bring the science to the table, the information, you know, but aren't necessarily always great communicators. You know, you do need people who know how to do outreach, who know how to talk to people. You need to have NGOs that will advocate, but that's not the scientist's responsibility. In fact, that would probably be considered bias if you're out advocating for things. And then you have the managers from the federal government, and even the local managers can work with the federal government to get things done that they want done. The problem, like you say, is in all this mass, if you Google dolphins, you're probably, your first 100 hits are going to be of things you shouldn't be doing with a dolphin, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So somehow finding a way to get through all that to the people, to the public who actually drive these decisions. I mean, all these management decisions go through these giant policy processes. I mean, it'll take years, as you know, here in New Zealand to get something done. And then it's usually some compromise that's sort of partly what you need to do, but isn't going to fully protect the animals because you have to consider all these other factors. So it's better in some ways to not have to rely on the regulatory framework and be able to actually get to a tipping point where people in the public believe that they should behave a certain way and actually self-enforce that.
Do you get conflicts with fishermen and other organizations locally that kind of don't like the approach that you're saying to protect dolphins? Do you have do you find resistance to that, those approaches locally, or do people just buy in because dolphins are cool?
Well, there's some resistance among tour operators to change their behavior if they feel strongly that they're going to make more money by not doing so. But as I say, there's also tour operators who feel like in order to sustain tourism, they have to behave in a responsible way or dolphins won't be there for future tourism. Fishermen, you know, the fishing interactions is an entirely separate thing. I mean, I don't think fishers are all that interested in how we conduct tourism one way or the other.
Yeah.
You know, there are certainly issues with fisheries interactions, and local communities and the state and federal government and lots of NGOs are working hard to try to find ways to solve those problems. And I guess it just remains to be seen whether or not they can reach agreements or not.
So, when you're, I'm just going to flip back to the genetics work that you do. So you're identifying, a lot of people saying we've suddenly discovered that we had like 18 species of dolphins, you know, 50 years ago, and now we've got hundreds. And so when you say that the local population of dolphins only stick to one island, are they kind of, are you being able now to identify little subpopulations, like subspecies that, and how would you identify them?
Yeah, so we collect samples from dolphins across the range, and genetics isn't the only tool we use. We use photo identification where we identify dorsal fins of individual animals and recite them over time in a space. We tag animals with satellite tags, and we use acoustic monitoring and things like that. But with the genetics, we collect genetic samples. We can actually analyze the relationships between dolphins across an island area. So in the Hawaiian Islands, it's really interesting because those relationships are different depending on the species. So like the spotted dolphins, which were the animals I studied for my PhD work, have populations that are split up among the major island regions of the inhabited Hawaiian Islands. And that seems to be sort of the case with spinner dolphins as well. But say the false killer whale has an insular population and an offshore population, and the melon-headed whale has a population across the whole set of islands, and then this little population that doesn't really interact as much with the other one at the on the corner of Hawaii Island. Like, so there's these weird different things that are probably niche specializations. These animals behaviorally adapt, you know, to an area, and then they don't necessarily interbreed as much with the other animals. So eventually that causes population differences and speciation, you know, the Maui's dolphin, that was the genetics that indicated there was enough difference to suggest that there's really not enough interbreeding to call it the same with the Hector's dolphin.
And do you do the same thing as I do with the whales, sit in a prow of a boat and shoot a crossbow at the...
Yes. And actually, it's, you know, people have asked me the question, they're like, well, is it hurting the animals, you know? And there's been a multitude of studies on biopsy because of the concern about whether or not it would hurt animals. And all of the studies have shown that they recover. They don't really have major behavioral responses to it. In fact, they generally respond more if you miss because they hear the splash in the water and they might move away because something weird is up there. But we get so much information. You can do genetics. You can look at contaminant loads. You can look at stable isotopes to evaluate trophic feeding levels. Like it's such a great way to find out about the animals, and they have so much more in their own environment that, like, even when they fight with each other, they do more damage to each other than this little tiny biopsy dart. And in Hawaii, we have cookie cutter sharks that take these, like, fist sized chunks out of the sides of dolphins. And I mean, they seem to recover. So it's probably they're probably relieved that it's not something like that coming at them.
At least it wasn't the shark.
Yeah.
So are there other, obviously apart from the direct threats to the dolphins and interference, are there, like, you know, are people interfering with their food sources, or are there other indirect threats to the populations that you're encountering?
There may be. We don't know a lot about the diets of a lot of the dolphins and toothed whales off of Hawaii. You know, it's hard because Hawaii doesn't get a lot of strandings. We get some, but because it doesn't have a continental shelf, really, it just drops straight down. And the currents are sort of, it's really kind of an oasis in the middle of the ocean there. And there's lots of sharks and stuff. We don't get a lot of bodies up when animals die. So trying to figure out what they eat can be a little bit challenging when you don't have stomach contents to evaluate. But, I mean, we do have obviously active fisheries and things that could be in some competition, and a variety of other animals that are probably much more competition for them out in those areas.
And so what are the other threats? I mean, are there, like, is pollution an issue in Hawaii? And
yes.
And what kind of pollution are you looking at then? Is it plastics, or is it just, you know, wastewater, or what kind of stuff?
All of those things are a problem. There's definitely issues with sewage management in Hawaii. There's a lot of places where we still use cesspools and injection wells, which are basically shoot sewage down into the ground, and eventually it percolates through and comes out in the water at some point. There are differing opinions about how, you know, there's some things that do get taken out of the sewage as a result of that, and then other things that don't. So we do have algal blooms and other problems probably associated with that. There's a lot of plastic trash. I mean, it's an area in the ocean where things gather too, so it's not even all local trash. And there's certain beaches where you just get tons and tons of it. One of the strandings we had recently, there was a plastic bottle in a false killer whale that was not what killed it necessarily, but there was one that it had swallowed. So we definitely have that kind of problem. They've done some toxicology studies on false killer whales. False killer whales, the insular population in the main Hawaiian Islands was listed as endangered recently in the U.S. Oh. So there's quite a bit of work done on that population, and they were finding that the pollutant levels in the blubber were a lot higher than they had thought they would be, and indicated they could be causing stress to the population. So there's these persistent chemicals in the environment, you know, we don't even use anymore, like DDT, that just continue to cycle through. And if an animal is stressed, you know, it's probably fine if it has a little bit of stuff stuck in its blubber. Mm-hmm. But if it gets a little sick, or it has a little food stress and it starts metabolizing those fats, then it starts to feel the effects of some of these toxic substances. So
I'm just curious about the false killer whales, and they're a porpoise.
They're a dolphin.
Dolphin. Okay.
Yes.
So what's the difference between, so a killer whale is actually a dolphin as well?
Yes. That's right.
Okay. All right. Okay. And sorry.
That's okay.
So what's the difference between a false killer whale and a real killer whale?
They're just different species. I'm not quite sure why they call them a false killer whale. They do. They're known to occasionally eat marine mammals, I think. So that might be what they're kind of dark colored, but otherwise, they don't, to my eye, look that much like a killer whale.
So somebody just looked in the distance and thought, oh, that looks like a killer whale. And they said, no, it's a false killer whale.
I guess so. That's likely.
Looking at it. And so obviously so how well have the populations recovered from the 70s when we were like killing whales and hunting whales? So have the population, is there much interaction between dolphin populations and whale populations? Do they affect each other, or is that just?
They probably don't have strong effects on each other. There are interactions sometimes between dolphins and whales. dolphins are known to sometimes ride in the wake of a whale, just like they'll ride in the wake of a boat mm-hmm. kind of thing. And there's some other documented interactions. Great whale populations, it really varies. For humpback whales in the Hawaiian Islands, it's actually a very positive story that there's been increases in the numbers. They were, you know, numbering, you know, something in the thousands 20, 30 years ago. And, mm-hmm. and now the estimate, based on the science that was done, in the mid 2000s is that there's probably about 10,000 whales that come to breed in the Hawaiian Islands. And there's about 20,000, 21,000 in the population in that central North Pacific area. So.
And do we know what percentage of the original population that would have been? Do we have any idea about that?
You know, it's always hard to establish. There's some estimates. There was an estimate that was done, I think, in like 1978 that suggested there were only about 15,000 humpback whales in the North Pacific population prior to hunting. But, you know, we find that there's a lot of underreports, and there's several researchers that have published and even are at this conference too publishing new results on all of these Russian whaling ships that never reported all this catch. You know, like, it would totally throw off potentially by orders of magnitude how many whales there were originally. So it's very, very hard to say.
And we know one of the things I think a lot of people don't understand, and we're only, I think, thinking that we're beginning to get a real handle on this, is how species are keystone species or, you know, cornerstone species, whatever, mm-hmm. how they actually change the entire ecology by their presence and their absence then obviously changes the kind of ecology. So has, what importance do we have any real handle on how important spinner dolphins, those inshore dolphins have on the ecology of the local marine, environment?
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, I think we can imagine that, you know, apex predators are typically keystone species in their environment. And generally, they maintain diversity and improve populations of prey. It's sort of contra to what we would think. We're like, oh, that's an animal. It's conflicting with me. I want to catch this fish, so I should get rid of this animal, and then I'll have more fish.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, that's usually not the case. A great example of that is actually sea stars.
Right.
So the starfish or sea star lives in the intertidal. It's a voracious predator. Eats everything. Right. Well, it turns out that if you take sea stars out of that environment, thinking, oh, I'm going to have more shellfish in here, mussels are so good at competing, they outcompete everything else, and all you have is mussels in that area.
All right.
So you lose all your abalone and your limpets and your clams and your everything, you know. So so it turns out that predator is really important. Even though you'd think you're giving yourself more prey, you're actually not. And I suspect that a similar situation would exist for dolphins and sharks and those apex predators in any environment. They're maintaining the diversity and health of the populations that they prey on.
So, I mean, one of the recurring stories, of course, that we're hearing from all the marine mammal researchers is that it's expensive to research. We really don't know very much about these marine mammals. Very, very little. And we need to do more research. How do you start engaging, do you think, people or governments or, you know, agencies into putting more money into understanding our marine systems and marine mammals? And
well, my personal opinion is that we probably can't rely on governments to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are so many conflicting needs, and, you know, government is tax dollars, and that's all dependent on economics and such. Now, if you can find ways to partner with industry and answer questions that are going to be have some economic effect on something, that makes it a little easier. And I do think that we as scientists need to start thinking more about working either with NGOs that are working directly with public who care and with industry partners who have, you know, there's fishermen out on boats every day. When we try to get a boat to go out and do something, I mean, that could be like $100,000 to just go out for a week and do research on a boat. You know, if we can work with partners to collect information and to use equipment and things like that, it's definitely a lot easier than trying to beg the government for money.
So how do you sell that story about saving dolphins is gonna you know, help your profits? How do you sell that story?
Well, if you are making billions of dollars a year on marine mammal tourism, which is in fact the numbers.
Really?
Yes, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, marine mammal tourism across the world, and if you're in a fishery, which also is affected by the rules and regulations associated with dolphins. Those are two very, very big industries that care about research on marine mammals. So those would be the first two that I would look at. There's probably other people who care too.
Talking about commercial interest, do you think we'll ever see a recovery to the extent that there could be a commercial harvest again?
Of which?
Of whales.
Well, I think with the baleen whales, it's unlikely just because they're... reproductive rate is so slow, and the amount you'd have to catch in order to make it economically viable as a commercial harvest, I'm skeptical. I know there's a few countries like Norway and that have implemented their minke whale hunt, I believe, and that's the smallest of the baleen whales. Or I suppose there might be some pygmy ones that get smaller. In general, that's the smaller one. For other marine mammals, I don't necessarily have the same opinion. I do think there are certain marine mammals that, you know, some dolphins, seals, sea lions, that kind of thing, that you could have some kind of harvest on, but you have to do it in a sustainable way. I mean, you can't just take. You know, they do reproduce slowly, and you do have to think about the impacts that you're going to have. And I also believe strongly in subsistence and cultural hunts and activities. I mean, I don't think that I can impose my U.S. values of thinking dolphins are really cool onto, you know, a group of people who thousands of years have been using this animal in their cultural practices.
And we touched on this a little bit earlier, persistent chemicals in the environment that are bioaccumulating in the species. I've read a few reports how there's a lot of mercury poisoning these chemicals are turning up in dolphins and in sharks, for instance. Do we have any understanding of how that's actually affecting them? You said before, if they get sick, it hurts them because they're absorbing the chemicals from the blubber. But do we have any other solid evidence about how it's actually affecting them, or do we understand that?
Well, heavy metals work a little differently. The blubber contaminants like the PCBs and DDT kind of derivatives are a little different than heavy metals are generally processed through organs, so the liver and the kidneys and things. So in an effort to try and, you know, basically what the body does is try to make them into something more inert to pass through the body. So there actually is I'm a little out of the loop on this. I read up on this a little bit further back. So maybe there's someone who has better data than what I have seen, but there are some mechanisms by which marine mammals do process those kinds of things, and perhaps better than one might think. But, you know, there's going to be a threshold for any animal that you get to a point that it's going to affect their health.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I wouldn't say that. I do have opinions, but you know, as a scientist, it's really important for me to go into a situation and do my research without having a desired outcome. You know, I mean, I just want to see what's true, whether or not that supports my opinion or not. Maybe I'll need to change my opinion at the end of the day. But you know, I don't really think activist is a good way to describe my approach to things, but I would say that I am an environmentalist, and I do think that it's important that we understand and take care of our environment, and I'm hoping to do my little part to help that.
And what are the challenges that you've got for the next couple of years? You're in Portland now. There's not that many whales under those bridges.
No. Well, I'm actually still doing the bulk of my research work in Hawaii. So Portland is my home base, my academic base, but but I still intend to be traveling to Hawaii and doing work out there on Adonisetes. I actually think that, you know, there's a couple of challenges for me. One is, of course, funding, which is always a challenge, you know, but I think the other is I've started to develop some good collaborations, and I really think like you were saying, it's important to work with the communities. That's really the place where you can actually accomplish change, and you can get access to some of this, you know, knowledge and equipment and expertise that people who live around these animals every day have. So in Hawaii, there's a lot of mistrust about people coming in from outside, understandably so. Hawaiians are not actually recognized as a native people by the U.S. government, so because there were no treaties, you know, we just annexed it. So there's a lot of issues obviously associated with that. So I'm like the girl from Nebraska, right? I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I'm coming out to Hawaii to tell you how to manage your dolphins, right? Which is exactly what I don't want to do. What I want to do is help facilitate your management of your dolphins by translating information about science to you and bringing your information to the managers who make the decisions. So my challenge is to integrate even further into the community and gain the trust I need in order to accomplish those goals.
And in terms of community, what would you like to see our community of listeners do?
Well, I really, the message associated with approach of animals, it would be really great if people started telling other people about that message. I think that it's important for us to be respectful of wild animals, and as much as we love them, and we want to be close to them, I'm really hoping that the more people who hear that this is something that can damage animals, the more they'll talk to their friends and say, I'm going to go swim with dolphins, and say, that's not really very good for dolphins. A lot of people ask me, I say, I study dolphins. Oh, do you swim with dolphins? And I'm like, no, that's totally not the point.
And I wish we had to wrap it up, unfortunately. You're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM. Our guest tonight was Dr. Sarah Corbis. Our panelist was Professor Samuel Mann, and your host is me, Shane Gallagher. Our music is sourced from the Free Music Archive, and you can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe in iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Sustainable Lens on Radio.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.